In November of 1923, Zev Jabotinsky, the founder and leader of the Revisionist Party, wrote an essay called The Iron Wall. In this essay, he portrayed his perception on the future state of Israel and its relations with the Arab inhabitants. And he said, "The Arabs will never accept our existence in the region. Therefore, we need to set an iron wall, which will be based upon power, economy, strong society, and military power. And at one point, the Arabs will say that they accept us." For many years, this theory proved itself to be quite accurate. And I would say that even until recent years, you know, when Netanyahu was trying to portray the Abraham Accord as a peace for peace and not a peace for territories, trying to remove the Israel-Palestinian conflict off the table. But we got a really hard reminder on October 7th. So I want to speak about the Iron Wall theory, about this essay, and about present days. And for that, I have my friend Nir Eisler from the Beryl Katzenelson Foundation. Nir, welcome back to Balagan. Those are sad times, but I'm glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to. Pleasure to be here always.
What we spoke about was the collapse of conceptions in Israel. And one of the biggest conceptions that was portrayed for years by the right wing in Israel, and especially by Benjamin Netanyahu, was a conception brought up by Zev Jabotinsky in his essay, The Iron Wall. So let's start first thing by providing a context to our audience about what was the Iron Wall.
The Iron Wall, Us and the Arabs, was an article wrote by Zev Jabotinsky, the founder of the Zionist right wing, a very important, influential, and prolific intellectual and political leader.
Of the revisionist Zionism. The founder of...
Yeah, Zionism.
Right.
Of revisionist Zionism. He was a great figure, although a controversial one. He published this article the 4th of November, 1923, in Berlin, in the Russian written Zionist newspaper. And this article... laid the foundation to Jabotinsky's Zionist, let's say, political ideology, influenced Zionism, including his rivals, like Ben-Gurion, for many years. And in a way, it still shapes, not the article, obviously, but the perception that lies in its core, still shapes Israel's relationship with their neighbors today, especially with the Palestinians. In the Iron Wall, Jabotinsky basically tries to answer to debate with the leadership of the Zionist movement and the more moderate fractions of Zionism. Some of them had their own misconceptions. At the time, they thought a binational state is a good solution. It was also far from reality. But furthermore, he says something even deeper. What Jabotinsky is saying is basically that we can't expect in any way to have peace with the Arab nations unless they are forced to acknowledge our existence here. He says, and he wasn't wrong. In a way, it was more, his pessimism was at least partially completely justified. I mean, in some ways it was completely justified because the Arab nations really didn't want to acknowledge our existence here. So in this sense, Jabotinsky had a point. The thing is that he negated even to strive for a dialogue, for understanding, for the ability to be a part of this region and to cooperate with the moderate Arab nation. He basically was against even the attempt to achieve peace, because his notion was that we will always be considered an external kind of a hostile force, colonial force.
Yeah.
And the only way to make them kind of acknowledge our existence was to create an iron wall. That was his metaphor. A very strong military and economical and political strength, and to become a regional, let's say, superpower in regional terms.
In this like, way the local, to, like the local empire that we are today, I would say.
Yes, yes. But the thing is that, exactly. But the thing is that Jabotinsky, a conservative, he will discuss this later, but in more details. But Jabotinsky is a conservative, he has this notion, unlike other Zionist leaders, which were essentially anti-imperialist and anti-colonial. That's an important notion, because Zionism is mistakenly perceived, especially by anti-Zionists around the world, as an imperialist, kind of colonial movement. And therefore, all the self-righteous post-colonials today condemn Israel. Some of them are completely blind and in a morally shameful manner to the monstrosities caused by Hamas and the October the 7th. But Zionism was, in fact, an anti-colonial movement in a very profound manner. And Jabotinsky, he, in a way, really believed that at least in the first stages, the Hebrew state that will be founded has to be a part of the British Empire, has to rely on the English crown, to serve the crown. And he actually believed that without the imperialist order organizing the region, we won't be able to exist. And kind of an anecdote, that's a very, not very known or not very remembered part of the Iron Wall equation that Jabotinsky presented, was that he objected the armed force by pioneers, that was the latest foundation to the Haganah, Israeli military force.
The pre-IDF organization,
exactly. That was the infrastructure of the IDF. And Jabotinsky was against it. He actually ridiculed, the most heroic achievement was the creation of this Israelis or Hebrew settlers actually defending themselves. And Jabotinsky ridiculed it. He said that he doesn't trust Jewish soldiers if they don't have the British army, the strength of the British army behind them. He thought that Jews defending the Hebrew state should be a part of the British army, not an independent force. So that was a very, not very nationalistic and sovereign perception, as you would expect.
Yeah, not many people know that, to be honest, because they always portray the revisionist movement as the more, I would say, the hardcore right-wingers. But yeah, they were always a bit less practical, I would say, than, Ben-Gurion and the socialist Zionism that believed in finding solutions that were dependent on ourselves and not dependent on other, I would say, foreign agents or other countries.
But I would just say that in an article that I published in Telem Online and with the same headline for this episode of the podcast, I actually showed that it is a right-wing perception, a very, very profoundly right-wing perception of preserving and relying the current power structure, in a way it becomes subjugated by this the power that be. The ones in power today, we kind of right-wing state of mind is to not only acknowledge them, but in a way kind of become self-obliterating in front of them, kind of be accept them as your masters. In this manner, it is very right-wing, not national way, but in a kind of international way, but to say that, the British Empire is the strongest power in the world right now, we should lower our head into a kind of swear allegiance to the crown, instead of the very left-wing and notion of anti-colonial freedom fighters fighting for our own independence.
Just a reminder to our younger audience who is not familiar with the term the British Empire, it actually comes from, 100 years ago, when they used to brag that it's the empire when the sun never sets. They had outposts and colonies all the way from the Far East, all the way around the globe. So
yeah, to India, Africa.
America.
Yeah, but you know, the old English
not the USA, but
the reason that the sun never sets on the British Empire.
Yeah.
Because God doesn't trust the English in the dark.
And in a way, what you're saying is that even today, you know, we switched it from, let's say, from the United Kingdom, from the UK to the USA, even if we're not saying it out loud.
Yeah. Yeah. Today, I would say that ironically, not intentionally, this aspect of the Iron Wall is fulfilled by Netanyahu. Not only this aspect. It's also an aspect because Israel now is really a kind of an American protectorate or an American colony,
yeah,
more than an independent state. The fact that they actually invite Anthony Blinken to the
cabinet meetings,
the cabinet in the Kiryat, the most most secret and protected meeting of the most restricted,
yeah, of the heads of the heads of the security forces. Yeah, but in a way, you know, I would say that you know, we had no other choice, especially when the US actually showed, even though this government slammed the Biden administration, actually it was the Biden administration that, yeah, proved to be our biggest supporter. But that's actually a topic for another conversation.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
So I want to move forward.
Maybe we'll have it also. I would just say that I'm in no way against this.
That you're against this?
No, I'm just saying that I'm in no way against this in the current. No, I'm definitely not against this in the current conditions. We should really be very grateful for Joe Biden, which is a far better leader to Israel right now than its supposed prime minister. And I would say much more Zionist and caring of the Israeli public than its own prime minister.
And I can tell you, as somebody who lives in the States at the moment, that he's actually a great president for the United States. I think that people are less appreciative of what he's doing and the efforts and you know, but because he's working in a really hard environment and hard circumstances.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you, because, you know, the Iron Wall seemed to prove itself at one point, because for many years, you know, the Arab countries fought against us. If we go and we're putting the Palestinians aside, and we put give a reminder to our audience, in 1948 we were attacked. You know, after accepting the partition plan, the Arab countries went to war against us. We were attacked by six countries: Lebanon and Syria in the north, Jordan and Iraq in the east, and Saudi Arabia and Egypt in the south, and we won. By the way, talking about that time, at that time, Jordan could have given the Palestinians the West Bank. Egypt could have given them Gaza, but this is not the topic of our conversation, why the Arab countries didn't give the Palestinians a state, but that's...
So they never wanted to solve the Palestinian problem.
Yeah, because it was actually a tool to go against Israel, because they couldn't agree with our existence. And only after, I would say, you know, the Yom Kippur War, and, you know, that after them we had the Camp David Accords with Egypt and the peace process with Egypt, only then, you know, it proved that eventually, in many ways, the Iron Wall theory proves itself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, over the years, we had Jordan who made peace with us. And then we had, of course, the Abraham Accords, and everybody was talking about now of, you know, a potential deal with between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And I will say, I'm not saying peace agreements, because we were never officially in a war, neither with the Emirates or with Saudi Arabia. So they're not considered to be enemy states.
Not officially and not unofficially. We were just never really in a war with them.
Yeah, they
didn't accept us, our existence, and they didn't cooperate with us, at least not officially.
Yeah, but we saw over the years that things are changing, and especially in the last couple of years under Netanyahu, who was trying to push the Palestinian problem or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict off the table. It seemed that it worked for him. You know, we had the Abraham Accords, and everybody said, oh, you see, we proved that the math can be different, that we can make peace for peace and not peace for territories. But I think that on October 7th, we got a really hard reminder that the Palestinian problem was still there. So how can you explain this dissonance, you know, between what Netanyahu was trying to portray and what actually happened? And what was happened before, you know, between Netanyahu and Hamas? Because you talk about it a lot in your essay, so...
Well, it's a very good question, this dissonance, because it's almost unbelievable, the fact that Netanyahu was elected prime minister in 2009, and his campaign slogan was Netanyahu strong in front of the Hamas. You know, his whole campaign was based on him, or a large part of it was based on him promising to destroy the Hamas rule in Gaza. It's almost unperceivable and difficult to believe that he actually did the complete opposite. Almost at the moment he was elected. Gadi Shamni was then in charge of Pikud Merkaz, the command of the center region of the army.
Yeah, which was in charge on the West Bank, on Judea and Samaria.
Exactly. So we said... 2009, when Netanyahu became prime minister for the second time. At the same time, before Bibi was elected, he said, we fought ferociously against the Hamas. He said, "Nialnu marechet chorma," means like they went all the way against Hamas. And he's saying, Benjamin Netanyahu stopped everything. And not only stopped everything, he actually did everything that he could for strengthen the Hamas economically and militarily. He actually allowed, and not only allowed, he let them pass this money bags from Qatar containing together more than $1 billion during the years to Hamas, which is has enormous economical significance.
And that was cash money that was beyond all of the subsidies and the money they got from other institutions that were literally building them as a force.
Right. But it's kind of symbolic that they actually allowed this money to pass, which was completely in Israel's control. They also released more than 1,100 murderers, terrorists with blood, Israeli blood on their hands, including Yehiya Sinwar and Ali Kachi, one of the architects of the massacre of the October 7th.
Yeah.
Actually, the majority, most of the leaders of the military commanders of Hamas today were released in the Shalit deal by Netanyahu. It's not that Israel wanted to, it's not a conspiracy in the sense that Israel was happy to release them. But it is a part of a stable, ongoing, consistent policy in front of the Hamas, which we'll discuss in a minute. We'll just say that another thing is in 2014, in the middle of Operation Tzuk Eitan.
Yeah, Protective Edge.
Protective Edge, it's called in English.
Yeah.
Something even funnier in English.
I know. They always have awkward names for military operations.
Yeah. I don't know who's their audience. I won't say a commercial of what kind of company it sounds like.
Yeah.
Protective Edge, yeah. But Netanyahu probably leaked in 2014.
The operation plans.
Exactly. Not exactly the operation plans, but the fragment of information from the very secret meeting of the security cabinet, evaluating that reoccupying Gaza will cause around 500 deaths of IDF soldiers, which is horrible, of course. But he actually leaked it to justify his willingness to not destroy the Hamas rule in Gaza. Now, the thing is that even though it may seem understandable in the short term, actually this choice of Bibi to perpetuate a rule of a terrorist organization completely openly committed to the not only to the destruction of Israel, but to
to eliminate all infidels. It's a part of the exactly. Muslim Brotherhood.
Exactly, and specifically to perform a genocide against Jews, which is also part of their theology. So this kind of organization that's completely, you know, everyone in his right mind won't consider this kind of organization a partner for peace. And Netanyahu actually openly, and he said so himself, and lots of the people closest to him said so. You know, people like General Gershon HaKohen and Bezalel Smotrich also said it. One that was of the closest to Netanyahu, but he was certainly one of his partners is today. And you know what Netanyahu actually thought, that we better save the Hamas, we better strengthen the Hamas and to weaken the PA, the Palestinian Authority, which is far more moderate, reasonable, sensible entity, which is hostile, Israel's enemy. And unlike other left-wing supporters, I'm not that optimistic or convinced that we have a partner for peace that is either willing or capable of attending it. But no doubt that you know, it's a fact that our cooperation, the military sense with the Palestinian Authority, saved countless lives. And it's consistent. We have a very fruitful cooperation with it. And no doubt that we have much more chance to achieve peace, or at least you know, a kind of partial arrangements that can allow both people that live in this country to live as peacefully as possible. So it's really unperceivable that Benjamin Netanyahu actually said so. He said, in a meeting of the Likud Center, whoever in March 2019, whoever wants to prevent the foundation of a Palestinian state should support strengthening the Hamas and to transfer money to the Hamas. It's part of our strategy to differentiate between the Palestinians in Gaza and to the Palestinians in Judea and Samaria.
It was a part of his strategy of, you know, Netanyahu is a master, I would say, in what you can call divide and conquer. Yeah. And it's actually a tragedy that we allowed, I would say, a jihadist organization that is a radical movement to grow and become so powerful because we wanted to eliminate the Palestinian Authority.
Exactly. Wouldn't say we, I would say Netanyahu.
Yeah, but we, when I'm saying we, it's the royal we.
No,
it's not
no,
you and I,
no.
But I'm saying we no. As Israel.
No, I know, and you're right, of course, but I specifically kind of make this distinction because it's important to say that there was a majority in the Israeli public for the two-state solution for dividing the country. And the Kadima party was actually elected. Ehud Olmert was elected prime minister, and he was elected after the Itnatkut, after the
disengagement, yeah, in 2005. I mean, he was elected 2006, but yeah.
Exactly. So I'm saying, even though we already paid this price, the Israeli public actually gave its voice to a party committed to peace, committed to separating from the Palestinians, separating not in the apartheid manner, but the other way around, to allowing two independent states to live next to each other in peace without occupying anyone occupying the other. So the thing is that Netanyahu basically made a very promiscuous bet, very responsible. Almost actually retrospectively, but not even retrospectively, it was from day one, it was a suicidal bet. He made a bet on the worst possible leadership in Gaza, not because he thought we have better chance to make peace with them, but just the other way around, because he knew that we don't have any chance to make peace with them, and he wanted to prevent the division of the land and maybe the loss of his settlers' allies, the political loss, and he wanted to do it by any means necessary. So what happened in October 7 was the direct result of this really quite insane policy. Maybe later we'll also try to discuss besides Bibi's political aspirations, the more profound reasons also connected to the Iron Wall ideology of Jabotinsky for this very surprising, I would say, choice to choose the Hamas, to prefer the Hamas over the PA.
So I want to ask you, because, you know, we're talking about Netanyahu, but I would argue that it's not just Netanyahu. Over the years, especially after the second intifada, I would say, Israel and Israelis, I would say, in a way, got addicted to the concept of, ניהול הסכסוך, managing the conflict.
Yeah.
You know, that we can minimize the amount of casualties and we cannot solve the solution. And it seems like, you know, that it worked for us for a couple of years. We had some quiet. But eventually, October 7th was a really, I would say, really, really painful reminder that the Palestinian problem is not going anywhere. And I want to ask you, because I want to be minded of our time, is what do you think, you know, if Jabotinsky was here with us today, what would he have thought about the Iron Wall? And would he, I would say, you know, write a new chapter?
First, I would say that this addiction is a very good, very accurate term that you use, because I think it is a large part of it. We became addicted to being protected by an Iron Dome, not an Iron Wall, but kind of a contemporary Iron Wall. Also the separation wall.
And actually the separation wall, the security wall in the West Bank that actually saved a lot of lives. I can say it as a Jerusalemite who was there in the first and second intifada.
Yeah, and I can say that someone, I and then my wife, we lived in Jerusalem for years, she more so, when she went there, the very fact that we could live there is thanks to that, and thanks to the very big success of the Israeli security system, you know, the Shabak, Tzal, all the security organizations. Thank God, that for the success. Obviously, the price by becoming by relying on that was the vanity that made lots of Israeli politicians think that you can just. Not only can, but we should just preserve things, keep things how they are, and to continue to support, to rely on our military being kind of invulnerable. That's what it felt like. And then we can just keep Hamas on, low
heat. Defenses. Yeah.
On defenses. Yeah, kind of a guarantee in Bibi's eyes that we don't have to divide the land. So it was an addiction. It was a very dangerous addiction. I think it was the consequence of something that, today's government in Israel is poisonous. It's populist, it's proto-fascist in many ways. It's a real, more than a government, I would say, it's an immune system failure. It just attacks the country that it's supposed to serve. So that's a very, very extreme deformity that the Israeli right wing, the Likud, and not talking about the liberal right wing, talking about the populist right wing, how low it got. But the policy we discussed today is a consequence of a different, a much more conservative, classical right wing perception that Bibi held for many years, even before his populist shift.
Because he always used to take some more moderate party to be his, as I always like to say, his...
breaks.
As his breaks, exactly. As somebody to put the blame to, by the way. That, I can't run the policies because of them. And now when he's having the government, he's saying that it's because of the Supreme Court. But that's, once again, it's, you know, it's actually a topic for a longer episode, another episode that we can definitely discuss on. But, you know, it's not, the reason I said it, it's because when you hear the history and of all of the rockets that were fired, and we're not talking, by the way, a lot of people are confused because the right wing is saying that Hamas started firing rockets at us only in 2006, but this is wrong. They actually started firing in 2001 when we were still in Gaza. But in time, the number grew and also the accuracy grew. And I think that, you know, the tolerance of the what we call the Gaza envelope people, along with, you know, developing the Iron Dome system, made the Israeli government actually more relaxed with finding a solution to the rockets, which I would say, I would argue that no country would ever agree to have missiles and rockets fired on its citizens for such a long period of time. And, you know, when people are talking, you know, about Gaza and Hamas, and they confuse it, do all the, you know, mishmash with the West Bank without understanding the whole story, drives me nuts. But when I think about how the Israeli government in many ways actually abandoned the people in the Gaza envelope, it drives me nuts, because it's not just now. I would say that now is the peak, but you know, when you have an enemy that is firing at you constantly, it doesn't make any sense. And we have the same danger coming from the south, from the north now with Hezbollah, and we need to see what to do with that.
Should have never allowed this to happen. It's infuriating and it's unforgivable. It is unforgivable.
Yeah, and maybe that should be a part of the new Iron Wall concept.
Yeah, but you see, the fear of change, and this obsession of preserving the constant power structure, because you're so afraid of being weakened if we actually change to try to reshape reality. That's the Achilles heel of right-wing perception, and I think that was what led part of what led Bibi in a combination with the growing dependence in messianic settlers, which are more motivated of very different, completely irrational theology. But the combination between both is, I think, the main reason for this policy. You asked me what I think that Jabotinsky would think today about the Iron Wall. Well, I don't really know, obviously. I do know that Jabotinsky would probably never have developed this alliance with the very exile-like Judaism of the Orthodox settlers, of the Messianic settlers. Jabotinsky was a liberal. He was a humanist. He was a secular leader. And I do know, actually, and I wrote another article about this, what would have Jabotinsky thought about the regime revolution led by the current government. And that I can say definitely that not only would have firmly objected to it, he actually did so. He kind of a way projected this 80 years before it happened, actually said that a democracy isn't a democracy because of an election process alone. Democracy means freedom. Without liberal rights, without limiting the power of the government, without free press, and without equality, it can never be a democracy. Going to the polls once every 4 years, unlike current populist claim, it's far from being enough for a regime to be a democracy.
Nir, sadly, I mean, we can speak about it for a lot more time. And we definitely need to set up a time to discuss what will be politically, but we'll do it on another time. First thing, I really want to thank you for joining me today and enlightening us. First thing, giving us the you know, the historical context of the Iron Wall and the right wing, I would say, of the revisionist party's right wing. and also giving the connection to what is happening today and how eventually this conception that was leading us for years sadly failed.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure as always.
Yeah.
We'll continue this conversation soon.
Definitely. And stay safe.
You too. All of us.
Amen.